AJ.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the program. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. How's everybody doing? You okay, Cliff?
Doing good.
Yep, I'm good. Splash a little water on me, so.
Our phone number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. 8976. We invite our listeners to give us a call and chime in and join in on the conversation. This evening we're going to be talking about mandatory minimums, and there are a lot of initiatives underway as far as judicial reform and prison reform, sentencing reform, and so forth. So there's a lot of information out there talking about that. Congress bipartisan initiatives are underway as well. Joining us a little bit later will be Mike Riggs. And Mr. Riggs is the communications director for FAM, and FAM is Families Against Mandatory Minimums, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that is fighting for smart sentencing laws to protect public safety. So we'll talk a little bit about that, and so we're going to also use a little bit of our time to talk about the IRP 6 and how the sentencing disparity raised its ugly head in the IRP 6 case. But before we do that, Lisa, let's do the disclaimer.
All right. We want to remind everyone that we're not attorneys and that A Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. You want to contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast. And as always, we want to thank you for choosing to spend a little time with us this evening and tuning in.
And, you know, I was talking about the IRP 6. The IRP 6 are David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. And these gentlemen started a company called IRP Solutions back in 2003. They were developing software for law enforcement at all levels, local, state, and federal. The company was raided in 2005. And basically, we're talking about a company that got in debt and was prosecuted for it. As the case proceeded, you ended up having two grand juries, and we're doing this review for the benefit of our listeners who may not be familiar with the case. But at any rate, there were two grand juries. The first grand jury said that there were no crimes committed and that it was, in fact, what it is, a debt collection case. The assistant U.S. attorney who was prosecuting the case, Matthew Kirsch, impaneled a second grand jury, and that grand jury returned an indictment. The guys had court-appointed attorneys. Those attorneys did not do the due diligence necessary to put forth a credible defense. So they ended up firing those attorneys and representing themselves pro se. By all accounts, it appears as though, and the record will show, actually, that Judge Arguello, who was the judge who was presiding over the case, did not give the IRP 6 the benefit of the doubt. As a matter of fact, Cliff, the times that we've spoken to other professional litigators, lawyers, and retired judges and so forth, they indicate that Judge Arguello held the IRP 6 to a higher standard than someone who had spent years going to law school.
Yes, and it just shows how much Judge Arguello, instead of playing the referee as a judge, ensuring that both sides were fair as far as the law went, that she went out of her way to ensure that the prosecutor had an upper hand. And she did this by not allowing expert witnesses, not allowing evidence to be presented. And also she did this by violating the Fifth Amendment rights of the IRP 6. I mean, during one of the days of trial, there was a delay as far as getting witnesses there. And just to put it into perspective, Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch said it was going to take him somewhere on the order of approximately 3 weeks to present his case. Well, he rested his case in a week and a half. And so At that point, it put the defendants, the IRP6, in a position where when they called their witnesses, they had to redo schedules as far as flight arrangements, hotel arrangements, days off works and things of that nature, because a lot of their witnesses were coming from the East Coast, Eastern Seaboard. And instead of Judge Arguello understanding this and seeing that Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch had used this tactic basically to put the IRP6 at a disadvantage, she reprimanded, rebuked, reproved the defendants for not having a witness there. And like I said, I mean, when you look at this, you say, okay, you're talking about a 45-minute break that she could have said, look, we're going to go on recess. We're going to do whatever we need to. We understand that the defendants need to reschedule some of their witnesses. But instead, she reprimands them, tells them that if one of them does not take the stand, that she would rest their case for them. And when we talked to one law professional, one judicial professional, he used the term, he said, hey, that put them, the defendants, the IRP6, in between a rock and a hard place. It's like, do I lay down my Fifth Amendment right and take the stand, or do I allow the judge to close the case? I mean, either way, you're in a bad predicament. And so they took the former, bad situation and said, hey, one of us will get on the stand, and, after being forced by the judge. And that is a Fifth Amendment violation. You cannot force a defendant to take the stand. And so she did that. But the even crazier than that is that this transcript that shows this sidebar, because it was a sidebar conversation where she basically told them they were going to have to take the stand or she rest the case, this sidebar conversation is nowhere in the transcript. And even Judge Arguello herself has made a statement on the record that says there is something that I said during the court proceedings that is not in the record. And the fact is, when there's something missing from the record, something missing from the transcript, I mean, any piece, because somebody can make something up. They can say, well, the judge spit in my face and it's not in the transcript. So at that point, the case needs to be retried, if nothing else. But when you have something as gross as a Fifth Amendment violation, then absolutely this case should be pulled back down, if not retried, just pretty much thrown out in the first place. Because, I mean, it is a debt collection case. It had no business in the federal courts anyway. Like you said, Sam, the first grand jury said, hey, there's no indictment. The second one, you call the prosecutor, Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, calls one witness, a FBI agent, Agent Moen, that basically tells lie after lie after a lie to get the indictment from the grand jury. That's why we say that process needs to be revamped, if not thrown away as well. But you look at all these situations that happened during this trial, all the things that went wrong, that went bad for the defendants. And then even to this day, that portion of the transcript has never come to light. And you have these men that have been sitting in federal prison for 2.5 years. And at the very least, they should have been able to get their transcript.
Absolutely. And just going back a little bit, Elamon, I'm going to ask you to speak a little bit on pro se representation, because, that's going to take us to another case that Judge Arguello presided over involving other pro se litigants in the state of Colorado. And so, we talked about the IRP6 representing themselves. And the attorneys that were part of the case initially did nothing to prepare for the case. There was no strategy put in place. And when the IRP6 asked their court appointed attorneys to accompany them to the U.S. Attorney's office, John Walsh, and to present a proffer as to what IRP was actually doing, all of those attorneys joined forces and basically said that they were not going to support the IRP6 in that meeting. It was at that meeting where they ended up firing those attorneys. But, as we've talked about many times on this program, the IRP6 did an excellent job of representing themselves. And I know, Lamont, you've talked about it previously on the program. So for those listeners who may not understand what pro se representation is, if you could share that and the benefits of that.
Well, it basically boils down to the fact that, you know, we live in a world where the system, as we have seen here, is beyond flawed. Well, whenever you have human beings running a system that don't have the integrity, that don't have that don't have the passion, and that really don't take their oath seriously as far as representation, I believe this is what the forefathers saw as a possible issue down the road for people to go pro se. And I pulled something up here. It's just a quote here that says that lawyers were actually pro se litigation was the rule rather than the exception in early American history, that lawyers were actually banned outright or faced tight restrictions in many colonies for much of the 18th century. It says here that the body of liberties adopted by the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1641 expressed the typical attitudes of the time, that every man that findeth himself unfit to plead his own case in any court shall have liberty to employ any man, provided he give him a fee, etc. Going into basically that the purpose of lawyers was it put in place by the forefathers for one purpose, that a man was unable to defend himself. And he was in a position where he could go further and get a attorney, someone that could speak on his behalf and defend him. That was the purpose. When our system left that type of protocol, if you will, I don't know, but apparently it came to the point where the forefathers shortly after that said that Americans, citizens had the right to defend themselves, because somewhere in history things begin to turn. Lawyers begin to not be as committed to defending another man as, say, a man would necessarily, or a woman would be, in defending themselves. So the right to defend yourself is definitely something that has started many, many years ago as a result. So my thought is, Sam, is that if the pro se movement, if you will, started back then, as a result that the forefathers saw something then where lawyers were not showing a committed attitude towards defendants. Well, I mean, you can imagine how bad it has progressively gotten worse since that time.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the things in the IRP 6 case, when you look at the sentencing disparity, if you will, and how this points directly to the need for judicial reform, for sentencing reform as well. So we've talked about the IRP 6 in the sense of they represented themselves pro se. There were several violations that were committed during the course of the trial, which have been challenged, are continuing to be challenged by a just cause. But then when you get to the sentencing phase of it, you know, this is a case that started off at, what, Cliff, $3.2 million or something to that effect, as far as debt. By the time everything was said and done, the records will show that that there was $5 million with all the fees and penalties and so forth. But that is basically what the record will show. Now, Judge Arguello sentenced the gentleman to anywhere from 7 to 11 years in prison. Now, you know, in under anyone's guidelines, that's excessive. And that's another point of contention where folks who are professionals in the field, as far as lawyers, retired judges, and so forth, all agree that that is excessive when it comes to sentencing. Now, to put it in perspective, the same judge, Judge Arguello, presided over a case recently in Colorado involving three people who were accused and convicted of $100 billion
tax fraud
case. What kind of sentencing did they get?
6 to 6.5 years.
Wow.
For $100 billion. And you're talking about people who, when you look at the IRP 6 case, I mean, these are six professionals. They've always, you know, been career-driven and business-minded men. And
well-respected in the community.
Right, well-respected in community, reaching out in their community, volunteering at their local church, local food bank, and places like that. Totally respectable to, you know, even the crooked judge Christine Arguello during this trial. When you look at these three people who got this, you know, this sentence for six and a half years for $100 billion of tax fraud, they were adamantly disrespectful to the judge during the entire trial. First off, it's on the record that they rarely even showed up to their trial.
That's right.
They were let out on bond pending sentencing. I mean, they didn't show up for their trial. Why would you think they would show up to the sentencing? On the day of their sentencing, obviously they did not show up. Two of them was out golfing, came in and still defied the judge. Said, "Yeah, you know, I hit a 69 or something to that effect today. You know, I feel like I had a good day. I played some good golf." Still totally disrespectful. You know, still spewing stuff as they were taken out of the courtroom. And then when they came back to get their sentencing, they were still disrespectful. You're like, okay, what penalty did they pay for their disrespect, not only to the judge, but to the courtroom and also to the law? But how do you the part of this that is just so amazing and mind-boggling, because you can't fathom, is like, how does somebody basically admit to tax fraud for $100 billion, go to trial, and the judge gives them 6 to 6.5 years for $100 billion in tax fraud, and feels like that is fair when you have another set of individuals that have debt, corporate debt, that says, yes, we went in debt trying to do business, and you sentence them to 7 to 11 years? I mean, you got mail fraud, wire fraud, and then you have federal tax fraud. Even if both parties are guilty, how do you compare those two charges? And IRP 6, like I said, this is corporate debt. These other three people, $100 billion in tax fraud, and you give them less of a sentence. That is why when you look at the entire system, when you look at what Congress is trying to do, they're saying, hey, and Attorney General Holder said it best, that there are far too many people in federal prison for no good law enforcement reason, that basically they have not broken a law. They have done nothing that says that they deserve prison time, but yet they are there. And there's so many reasons that you get people ending up in prison outside of breaking the law. I mean, you got the prison, you know, basically the business of prison, the things that prisoners, you know, basically the labor that prisoners do that are beyond pennies on the dollar, that these corporations can get things manufactured, can get work done, that, you know, child labor pays more than what these prisons pay a person. So there's just too many issues with the system, and I'm glad to see that, you know, Senators Paul Leahy, Massey, and Scott are really going after this to, you know, deal with what's going on in our prison system today.
And, you know, Cliff, the senators have come together as far as bipartisan initiatives for sentencing reform, prison reform, and so forth. And, you know, they're taking a really close look at crimes that are committed regarding nonviolent drug-related crimes and so forth. But, you know, that really opens the door for an across-the-board reform, because when judges take it upon themselves to, I mean, we already know that the guidelines are just that. They're guidelines.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, how can you have a situation like this with Judge Arguello where you have let's just use the broad brush term of white collar crime,
right?
And you throw the book at one group of people, and then you're extra lenient on someone else, but the dollar amounts involved are light years apart. And in the IRP 6 case, it is clearly substantiated that's debt,
right?
In the case of these the guys with the $100 billion tax fraud, they admit to the fact that, yeah, they were trying to make a statement, and that they were doing what they were doing, trying to make a statement. But in the way they were going about doing it was illegal.
Right. And they say they were trying to make a statement, but at the same time, they were also trying to collect tax returns
that they did, that were not owed.
Right.
Them.
That were not owed them for millions and millions of dollars. And it would be one thing to look at Judge Arguello compared to another judge and say, okay, these two judges, with similar cases, came up with two different sentences that are so far apart. That would be one thing that would still be wrong. But you have the same exact judge with two very similar cases, except for the dollar amount. And if the amount of loss and the amount of so-called fraud is supposed to be what determines your sentence, how do you compare 3 million to 100 billion?
It's not just.
It's light years away.
It's not just. And then Judge Arguello involved in the Delta Petroleum case.
Yeah.
Judge Arguello admonished, ridiculed, rebuked the IRP6 for basically saying that their company is got these opportunities with various government agencies, and she held out against them. But in the Delta Petroleum case, she said you can't hold it against the corporate executives if they're saying their company is good.
Just totally refuted herself and used the fact that they said that they had a great outlook for their company. Use that fact to basically say they're not guilty because they have the right to feel that way and to voice that opinion as well.
When we come back, we're going to talk about sentencing reform, mass incarceration, that type of thing. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Hey guys, I'm Jordan Sparks.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Dude Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Blue.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
Do something good for your community.
Reuse bags and bottles and always recycle.
Help us collect 1 million pounds of food.
Help people prepare for natural disasters.
Do something about homelessness.
Anyone could be a rock star in their community.
So then do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Visit dosomething.org to find out how.
Our children are literally eating themselves to death.
Many experts predict that this may be the first generation of children that doesn't live as long as their parents because of the problem of obesity.
A quarter of American children don't exercise regularly. The average school-age child watches 4 to 6 hours of TV every day, bombarded by commercials for fast food and junk.
How you make these kinds of lifestyle changes in your kids is to make them yourself.
Make the effort. Fight childhood obesity. A message from the Government of Canada.
Sergeant Michelle Garcia served meritoriously in Iraq and has the medals to prove it. Soon after leaving the Navy, Lieutenant Chris Scott found a job, a home, and started a family of his own. Corpsman Richard Stokely took the skills he learned in Vietnam and put them to good use as a paramedic. But soon after leaving the military, each of these veterans fell on hard times and faced homelessness. Even after Michelle lost all her savings, even after Chris wasn't able to pay his mortgage, and even after Richard battled alcoholism for years, they each reached out for help when they needed it most. A simple phone call put them in touch with a trained professional from the Department of Veterans Affairs. That call got Michelle a place to stay until she could afford one of her own, put Chris in touch with employment assistance, and found Richard a substance abuse program. These veterans are success stories not only for how they were able to help others while serving their country, but for how they were able to let others help them. If you know of or are a veteran in need, make the call.
Join a Just Cause in the fight against wrongful convictions, judicial injustice, misconduct, and corruption. Contact us at 855-529-4252 or at www.a-justcause.com.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. And if you'd like to do a little bit of fact-checking on us as far as the IRP6 is concerned, go to freetheirp6.org. Free the IRP6.org. Out there you can find in-depth information about the IRP6 case, profiles on the IRP6, background information about IRP solutions, and then court documents as well. And you'd be intrigued by what you'll read out there. And also there's a blog out by David Banks, and it's called the Stand Up Blog. So click on the tab that takes you out to the blog, and out there you'll find some good reading as to the state of affairs as far as our judicial system and then how it impacted the IRP6 case. So, Cliff, I know you got an article over there that you want to share with our listeners regarding some of the things that are going on with regard to prison reform and sentencing reform.
Yes, this article comes from Senate.gov, so straight out of Washington, D.C. It's from Senator Rand Paul's website, and it is entitled Paul, Leahy, Massey, and Scott Lead Bipartisan Bicameral Introduction of the Justice Safety Valve Act. This bill is to ensure sentences consider mitigating factors in appropriate cases. And basically, what it is talking about is these mandatory minimum sentencing that has just been going on forever. And Senator Paul was quoted saying, since mandatory sentencing began, America's prison population has quadrupled to 2.4 million. America now jails a higher percentage of its citizens than any other country due to mandatory minimum sentencing. These sentences disproportionately affect minorities and low-income communities while doing little to keep us safe. The federal government should get out of the way and allow local and state judges to do their jobs. We must work hard in a bipartisan fashion to change these laws. And I would say that you allow these judges to do their job, but they still need oversight because you still have judges that if it were up to them, even with the mandatory sentencing, they would still give people higher sentences. And there still needs to be a check and a balance. And so, you know, you have the Safety Valve Act, which is supposed to begin that. And it says basically, you know, over the last several decades, they've had this tough on crime message. And Senator Leahy said, the truth is they do not make our community safer, talking about the mandatory minimums, and they are breaking the bank. They mean we send too many people to prison for far longer than is needed to keep us safe. Each time we do that, we waste tens of thousands of taxpayer dollars. We keep families apart. It's time we stop this irrational approach to sentencing, which is one of the reasons why we have the largest prison population in the world. Something has gone very wrong, and our laws must change. And he says, again, get politicians out of the way and let judges judge. And I think that's the part that we have to be careful about, because if you let judges judge and you give them total discretion to say you give this person whatever sentence you want them to have, then we have another issue where the judges are now in the position where they feel like they have the quote unquote God power even more, because they can say, I can give you whatever sentence that I want to. I think this safety valve should also include a maximum sentence based on the type of crime that you've done. I mean, some of these things, you look at people who have been in prison since the 80s, say, hey, I got caught with an ounce of cocaine, crack cocaine, because powder cocaine, they give you a much lighter sentence because it's not typically found in a minority community. So crack cocaine, which they, you know, basically dubbed as basically, you know, like Satan's poison, because it was more toward minority communities dealt with crack because it was a cheaper
to
form.
Produce.
Yeah, cheaper yeah. To produce. It's basically, you know, cocaine that's basically been stretched with something like baking soda bleach, something like that. But you have a person who's been sitting in prison since 1985, 1994, having 1 ounce of drugs. How does that make sense to say you need to spend 25, 30, 50 years, the rest of your life in prison for something you did when you were 18?
Well, I'll tell you this from experience, that the sentencing situation, I know in the state of Colorado, is horrific. In my particular case, as I shared before, I was falsely incarcerated, but there was a minimum of 8 years to life that I was getting. Which means basically, and this is how corrupt the system has become, the Department of Corrections in states have taken liberty without any interference from judges, from lawmakers to say, wait a minute, this is not what this was intended for. And you have murderers with second-degree murder charges that I was with in prison that was going to walk in about 15 years. So you're telling me that and I agree with you, Cliff, on that point, that there has to be, wherever there's no accountability, wherever there's no oversight or an independent group of people that can say to a judge,
mm-hmm.
I think what we as a society has done and how we got here, I have no idea, to give these judges this power when we have reports, we have statistics showing judges walking in a high level of abuse of power. So if you got judges that are abusing that power, well, politicians can't get out the way because
right.
That's the only somewhat
that's supposed to be the
stopping
buffer.
Point,
yeah.
The buffer in the middle there. So if you take that away, and I appreciate what the congressman people are attempting to do, but they need to get a little deeper with
right.
that.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we have, again, Judge Arguello is a perfect example.
A perfect example.
Of a person who does whatever she wants to do, when she wants to do it, with no regard for the law. Well, what do you do with those judges?
Mm-hmm.
There has to be, and my understanding was that you had chief justices in states that were there to oversee the conduct of these judges at the local level. Well, they're not doing anything because they don't want to offend the presiding judge.
Exactly. I mean, when you look in the case of the IRP6, when some of these issues that were going on with Judge Arguello were brought to the chief judge's attention, the chief judge recused himself. It's like, Who is the overseer at this point?
How does the overseer recuse himself?
Right, be like, well, I'm not having anything to do with it. You know, I'll be basically vacating my seat and I'm going into, you know, quote unquote retirement to where I really don't have to try any cases. I just get a check in my benefits. And it's totally ridiculous.
Right.
But when we go back to this article, we see that Representative Scott said mandatory minimum sentences have been studied extensively and have been found to distort rational sentencing systems, discriminate against minorities, waste money, and often require a judge to impose sentences that violate common sense. To add insult to injury, studies have shown that mandatory minimum sentences fail to reduce crime. Mandatory minimum force federal judges to issue indiscriminate punishments regardless of involvement, criminal history, mental health, addiction, and other mitigating factors. The Justice Safety Valve Act would apply the current safety valve provision to all federal crimes, allowing federal judges to tailor sentences on a case-by-case basis. That
right.
is where you fall into dangerous ground, is because now instead of you saying, okay, we have mandatory minimums, we're going to let the judges feel like on a case-by-case basis, you do what you deem necessary. If a judge doesn't like you, well, you know what? I'm going to give you 20, 30 years.
And that's
just
what
because.
And I think that's what it comes down to. And I salute Congressman Scott.
Right.
I went to a hearing there in Washington, D.C. some months ago, and he was addressing this issue very, very vehemently against these things. And he had one of the FBI directors or assistant director there saying, this absolutely makes no sense. It's
yeah.
insanity is what it is. So we salute the congresspeople at least attempting to make a progressive move forward. I think it's a good thing.
And joining us now is Mike Riggs. Mike is the communications director for FAM, and FAM is Families Against Mandatory Minimums. And Mr. Riggs and that organization, they are playing an active role in sentencing reform. Welcome to the program, Mr. Riggs. How you doing?
I'm well. Thank you for having me on.
So how is the weather breaking a little bit there in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, yeah. It's just cold and wet and mushy out. And we don't handle snow well here, though. So the you know, federal government was closed today, over 4 inches.
Yeah.
But.
Oh, wow. For 4 inches of snow, huh?
Yeah, just four inches. I mean, I'm from Florida, so I can't claim to be some kind of expert at navigating this. But it seemed excessive.
All right. Well, at any rate, so talk to us a little bit about what Families Against Mandatory Minimums is doing as far as sentencing reform. It looks like, you know, there's a lot of bipartisan activity going on right now, and everyone is jumping on the bandwagon to get reform there, and also, which, you know, is obviously the reciprocal benefit of that is reduced prison populations and so forth. So talk to us a little bit about some of the initiatives that you have going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we're so close to the finish line here. FAM was started in 1991, just a few years after federal mandatory minimums had been created, and nobody had a real sense of what the impact would be. We know now that, we have a federal prison population that is basically making the Bureau of Prisons burst at the seams. The average drug sentence for federal prisoners has gone from 4 years to almost 10 years. So they've done an incredible amount of damage. And over the last probably decade, you've just seen more and more people who once supported this, even people who helped pass these laws, sort of peel off from this Tough on Crime coalition, step back and say, there has to be a smarter way to do this. And so what we've got now is we've sort of got this great culmination of advocates and criminal justice professionals and legislators, and we have two bills that we're rallying around, the Justice Safety Valve Act and the Smarter Sentencing Act. And I feel like 20 years ago, FAM was kind of trying to push this boulder on its own, and now just more and more people are helping us push, and we're like right at the top of the hill, but we've still got a few obstacles left.
So I know that FAM put out a press release a few days ago that says, U.S. House and Senate introduced an even smarter sentencing act, and that you applauded the bipartisan efforts here for this bill. So, explain to our listeners a little bit of what it takes to get that type of traction with Congress.
Oh yeah, that's great. That's a great question. I mean, basically, it kind of comes down to, in a weird way, constituent services. Every member of the House and every member of the Senate, even though they kind of get trapped in the Washington bubble, a lot of them still know that they are accountable to the people who elected them. And due to the fact that the U.S. prison population has just exploded, I mean, the number of people who come in touch with our criminal justice system every day is kind of horrifying. There are now just a lot of people in a lot of states, every district really, who know someone or have someone behind bars. So for us, it was what FAM has always sort of specialized in is getting in touch with prisoners, some at the state level, many more at the federal level, who are doing unjustly or disproportionately long prison sentences. And over the years, we went from sort of collecting these stories to saying, like, hey, these stories are about people whose families vote and who, have a right to go to their member of Congress and say, this doesn't work, this isn't fair, this isn't justice, do something about it. So over time, we've seen some of our greatest steps forward in this movement to restore, sanity to sentencing. It's come from introducing the family members of prisoners to members of Congress. And it makes a huge impact. I mean, because D.C. is not a city. I mean, we have no federal prisons in D.C. D.C. doesn't have, like, a state prison system even. We have some jails, and that's it. So a lot of these legislators have been just totally isolated from the impacts of bad laws. So introducing people who have experienced those bad laws or know someone who have two legislators has just done wonders.
Right, absolutely. And, Mike, this is Cliff Stewart. We appreciate you coming on the show, spending time with us this evening. My question is, we read about the Safety Valve Act that, they're fighting for right now in Congress. Is there a provision for capping the maximum sentences for these particular crimes, especially crimes like white-collar crimes, nonviolent crimes, crimes that, even if they're drug-related, are very minimal possession charges that a person has that right now they have minimal mandatory minimums? Is there some type of provision for a cap on these maximum sentences? Because my only fear, and I think it's great work what the senators are doing. I think it's wonderful. But my fear is that if you give these judges sheer that they're the only ones who control themselves, then they'll get out of control. If there's no rein on them, then they will take it upon themselves to say, because I don't like you, because I feel like what you did, you know, I may not like drug dealers more than I don't like manslaughterers. That is my concern, is that these judges will take it upon themselves to play that God role. So is there a cap on what these or a provision for a cap on what the maximum sentence can be for these particular charges?
Yeah, that's a great question. Right now, pretty much every federal law has a sort of, or federal crime has a, what's called like a statutory maximum, which is the idea that you cannot sentence over this certain amount for the crime. And, you know, as far as I know, nobody is actually working on bringing down the statutory maximums, just because the problem we have right now, there are definitely judges here and there who just have no sympathy for the defendant, and they basically just take whatever they give the prosecutors whatever they want. And and those judges, I mean, basically that is the worst thing that you can do as a judge, is to say, even though there are supposed to be three parties in the courtroom, technically four if you count the jury, but really there's the judge, the defense, and the state. And the worst thing a judge can do right now is just basically act as if the line between the prosecutor and the judge doesn't exist, and just give the prosecutors whatever they want. So in a lot of cases, prosecutors are using mandatory minimums to get whatever they want. They say, I'm going to charge you with crime A, B, and C, and if you get convicted, that crime already has a sentence. The judge is taken out of the equation. So let's say we reform mandatory minimums. We don't change statutory maximums. There's still this really high end of a range sentence you can get. Judges don't actually tend to go beyond what a prosecutor asks for. So again, the worst thing we'd see is that we'd fix these mandatory minimum laws, and then we'd still see some judges handing out sentences that are very terrible tomorrow, but no less terrible than the ones they're handing down today.
And
if that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense, and I think that is a great point, because when you look at the Innocence Project, and the record number of exonerations that happened in the year 2014, they had a record number of exonerations for those prisoners that had actually pled guilty to committing a crime. And when they went back and said there was no crime committed, and then the rest of them, they said the crime that was committed was not committed by this person that even pled guilty. And that's how the prosecutors bring in the fear factor to basically, like you said, Mike, say, hey, when I convict you of this, it already holds a 20-year minimum. And then once I convict you of that, I'm going to compound a conspiracy on top of it. Then I'm going to compound the fact that you premeditated to do it. And so I'm going to give you three life sentences just from convicting you on one thing. And like I said earlier, something as small as you possessed 1 ounce of drugs, and I'm going to put you in prison for three life sentences. And like you said, I mean, the prosecutors go totally berserk, feeling like, you know, I have to keep my high 98-99% conviction ratio. And even if, you know, even if a person confesses, I'm still going to give you a 20-year term. That is what is so sickening. And like I said, you get the exonerations of people that actually pled guilty, saying this is absolutely not the person who committed the crime, but what brought such fear that they pled guilty so a prosecutor that told them, if you plead guilty, I'll give you 20 years, I'll give you 30 years. If you don't plead guilty, when I take you to court and find you guilty, I'm going to give you life without the possibility of parole.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. And the reason they can get away with that is because our court system is not, I mean, there are the obvious biases in place, like mandatory minimums, but there are more subtle biases too. I mean, our plea rate is really high, right? But cases that go to trial, there's also a super high conviction rate by jury.
Yes.
So even if you are innocent, like you brought up the Innocence Project, you know, if you're well informed as a defendant, you know that your odds at a jury trial are terrible, regardless of whether or not you committed the crime. So one of the things that, you know, reforming mandatory minimums does at least is it takes some of the leverage away from the prosecutor. And it makes the prosecutor say, you know, even if this person refuses my plea deal and they go to trial, even if they lose, I can't hurt them that bad. So maybe I need to rethink whether or not this is somebody I should be trying to send to prison in the first place. Maybe there's a better way for this. Maybe there's a diversion program, drug courts, or, you know, home monitoring or probation. Because the problems that our criminal justice system is meant to address, it can't actually fix. It can't fix poverty. It can't fix broken homes. It can't fix, you know, institutional racism. It can't fix troubled public education systems. So, you know, we only approach the sentencing aspect of this because that's where you see some of the most egregious examples. You see drug offenders getting life without parole because they had two state possession convictions for which they served no time whatsoever. And then they get a federal conviction, and that becomes their third strike, even though those two prior state convictions were no big deal. They could have just been possession of marijuana. But then suddenly they're serving life without parole. So if you take away some of those worst abuses, it does reduce the incentives prosecutors have to treat people this way, but it doesn't address all the problems.
Joining us this evening is Mike Riggs, the Communications Director for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Mike, do you have a few minutes to stick around with us to come back after the break?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back with Mike Riggs. And, Mike, we have a clip that we're going to play on the other side of the break from Senator Mike Lee, where they, you know, held their press conference a few days ago, and we're talking about this. So we'll talk about that press conference when we come back. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Federal government targeted, prosecuted, convicted, six executives in, held back evidence, come on. Hundreds of pages of Mr. Manuscript, court circuit, 10th district denying the writ of mandamus, free the RP6, critical rights violations, scandalous, their motivation to finish, they finish with major companies, the government, New York PD, test potential customers, come on. Faith attempt to obtain funds from banks and angel investors with no success, that calm mail down, finance skeptics, so they hire a staff and come to fill the gap with every attention to fulfill the contract, to the deal when money come back, everybody paid the bills, the wages, take care of all of that, no Friday, they got viable software, but you compare them to those with nothing to offer, prosecuted by the attorney's office, before the FBI gotta start investigating charges, skipping steps in the process, even barring the testimony of Andrew Alvarez, a witness who could tell why any staffing company that could do a dumb restroom credit check would stick out their neck if there was no prospect they could collect. When they're reeling the net, it all relates to Harvey Silver's late statements about the vagueness of federal law, judicial chaos, A_justcause. Read at rp6.org, 347-205-9620, just blog. It's just us, but we don't gotta just talk. We can just march to the courts for the cause with one voice. It's just free them all. Come on.
No peace.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976, and they're laughing at me. trying to control the little bit under the weather. But joining us this evening, Mike Riggs, Communications Director for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Again, welcome to the program, Mike, and thanks for spending a little time with us this evening.
Yeah, thank you.
So before the break, we were talking about, and for our listeners who may be just joining us, we're talking about judicial reform and some of the initiatives that are underway on Capitol Hill with regard to sentencing reform and specifically looking at mandatory minimums. A few days ago, bipartisan coalition had a press conference, and Mike Lee, senator from Utah, led the way as far as introducing that particular press conference. So we're going to play a short clip from that press conference, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to have all of you with us today, and I'm very pleased and honored to be here with a very bipartisan group. As you may know, we don't always agree on everything around here. There is, however, one area, and this is one of a number of areas in which there's pretty broad-based bipartisan consensus that things need to change and that things need to be different. We're here today to talk about one of those issues, and that relates to our federal prison system. We've come together as a group of bipartisan lawmakers around an idea that's neither Republican nor Democratic, it's neither liberal nor conservative, it's simply an American idea. The idea that our federal prison system has become somewhat unwieldy. Well, we've done a great job at punishing and deterring crime in this country, but we may have overdone certain things over the last few years. But to put this in perspective, when we look at our federal prison system, look at what's happened to it since 1980. Our federal prison population has increased nearly tenfold since that time. Now, I don't believe that has been accompanied by a tenfold increase in the commission of crime. That has certainly been accompanied by, it's in many respects been caused by, the over-federalization of criminal law and the sometimes excessive reliance within the federal system on minimum mandatory penalties. These have very significant costs. A lot of people like to talk about the economic costs of lengthy terms of incarceration. A lot of people like to refer to the fact that it costs about $20,000 a year in this country to put a person in a minimum security prison. But that's, in my opinion, not the most significant cost. The most significant cost is the human one. The human cost, that I witnessed just this morning when I met with a woman who lives in Utah. She is the sister of a man named Weldon Angelos. Weldon Angelos, just a few years ago, received a 55-year prison sentence for a first-time offender drug crime. This is the kind of human cost that I'm talking about, where we've got entire communities where their husbands, their brothers, their uncles, their sons have been locked up sometimes for generations at a time. We have found some common sense reforms to our federal sentencing system that make sense, that are neither Republican nor Democratic, neither liberal nor conservative. They're simply American ideals. And I'm honored to be here with a broad-based bipartisan consensus around this bill.
So, Mike, on that, I know that FAM has been active even in the Weldon Angelos case. And it goes back to something that you said before with regard to, and I think Senator Lee touched on it here, where he said the human cost. And so, the human impact, the story behind the conviction, the story behind the excessive sentencing is what people need to recognize. And unfortunately, and I'm sure you find this in FAM, and we find it with a Just Cause as well, that a lot of times people tend to take a complacent attitude toward criminal justice, toward reform, because it hasn't hit them on their doorstep. But in the case of like Weldon Angelos, 55-year sentence, that's excessive any way you slice it. And so, you know, when you look at the human cost, I think that just hit the nail on the head, and you were talking about that earlier. So how can folks get involved to you know, bring more attention to the impacts on families? Because, it, you know, as you know, it impacts more than just that person that's behind bars. It impacts the children. It impacts the spouses and so forth.
Absolutely. And, to get involved, I think, shows like A Just Cause are helping, because the biggest hurdle we face is education. The average American doesn't research or learn anything about their criminal justice system until they or someone they know has to get involved with it against their will, either as a victim or as a offender. And so part of the problem is that people are just walking around every day not aware of these travesties, of these judicial travesties. And they shouldn't be aware just because, you know, so long as there's injustice in the world, we should all be like working to fight against it. But they should also be aware because it's bad for their communities and it's bad for their wallets. A giant, bloated, inefficient, warehousing of human beings is expensive. And offenders all come home one day. They're all going to come home. And for them to come home when they've done 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years, or in Weldon's case, 55, he'll be 78 years old when he gets out for selling about $500 worth of marijuana. That's expensive too. And we don't exactly have a prescription for what the ideal alternative to mandatory minimums is. We know that many judges oftentimes at the federal level say, I would prefer to give a sentence lower than this. We still don't have a lot of judges saying, I would prefer to put this person on probation, I would prefer to refer this person to drug court. We still have the issue of we're treating people who have mental health issues as criminals when really we should be trying to address their illness. We still don't look past offenders what they've done and say, you know, this person needs job training, not a jail. But for people to get involved, do the research. Go to a place like famm.org, famm.org. Listen to A Just Cause, and when you hear something and you're like, that's not right, dig in. You can call your senator. You can call your representative at the federal level. At your local level, you can write letters to district attorneys. You can talk to your state legislators. Everybody right now at the state and federal level, like, we have momentum on our side. And the thing we need the most is for people, not advocates, not people who get paid to talk about this stuff and work on this issue. And it would be great to have more legislators, but what we really need right now is people. We need voters. We need taxpayers. We need homeowners. We need business owners. We need people who, matter to their communities, pastors, school principals. We need these people to step up and say, you need to fix this. Things need to be different.
Yeah, and Mr. Riggs, Lamont Banks here, good to have you on the program. We appreciate what you're doing as well. I'll tell you this, and tell me your thoughts on this. I think even the deeper problem that we have, is I believe it's a, I don't know what word to put to it, that motivates judges. For instance, I was wrongfully incarcerated in the state of Colorado. I did 7 years for a crime I did not commit. And I met a lot of people that were doing 400 years plus life, two life sentences plus 50 years. What my position or my thought is that there seems to be a type of, what word am I looking for? A type of vengeful punishment by judges that are in a position that if a man has one life, what I have found in prison, when you give somebody three life sentences, the culture that is cumulating here in this country is coming down to take all hope from those that are incarcerated, to take everything. You know, if you sentence me to three life sentences and I only have one, that takes complete hope away from me. So when the senator makes reference to a human problem, a human cost, it seems to me that there seems to be a very cruel level of cruelty, if you will, that's being that's motivating some of these judges to do what they do. How do you sentence a man to three life sentences plus 300 years. I mean, just the... Go ahead, Mr. Ricks.
No, I was going to... When I see sentences like those, or when I hear those, I wonder, you know, if it's a mandatory minimum, which there is a life mandatory minimum, I wonder why the judge doesn't just get up and walk out of the courtroom and say, you know what, I quit. I can't. This is a stain on my conscience. But for a judge to actually say, I have discretion, but I'm going to give you all this time, I mean, there are no good answers to that, right? Like, federal judges get lifetime appointments. You put a mean, vengeful, uncreative judge on the federal bench, you are going to affect people's lives, many people's lives, for decades. And there are no good answers for that.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Just it is so troubling now that we see these things, and we wonder why the country, as far as the view of our justice system, is viewed so horribly bad. Because it's like, what is motivating you? And I think, you know, and I said this to the people here on the show before, there should be some type of oversight, some type of independent group of people that oversees the actions of judges. That what is, you know, you give a man too much power, he can destroy a nation. And like you said, these are lives that are affected for generations. And something, again, has to be done. And like you said, people are not educated on the horror. I've sat in cells with guys that, and I there was a story here, you know, Colorado has a horrible a minimum mandatory that they have here in the state of Colorado, which I'm sure you've heard of indeterminate sentencing, where you can get 2 days to life, 8 years to life. The thing of that, I knew a man that had gotten actually sentenced to 2 days to life. When I met him, he was on his 27th year. So every year he came up, they sent him back again. And again, the mental toil of that, the suicide rate in these prisons, I mean, it goes far beyond just giving somebody some time that they don't deserve. This goes to the mental crushing, if you will, of the human spirit. This is what makes it so vital. Absolutely. I appreciate that. Thanks for your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I also have to add that one of the things that you think would be a stopgap against these awful sentences would be, you know, the Eighth Amendment, which says, you know, there can be no cruel and unusual punishment. But unfortunately, the Supreme Court of the United States has a very, I would say, warped interpretation of what constitutes cruel and unusual punishment, which basically the Supreme Court has ruled many times over the years that excessively long sentences, even for incredibly minor crimes, is not a cruel and unusual punishment. So again, I mean, it's almost like we can't look the problems that are inherent with the judiciary, we can't look to the judiciary to fix. But, you know, you're talking about state stuff. A lot of those judges aren't appointed. I mean, I don't know about in Colorado, but in a lot of states, they have to run for office. And if you think that your only obligation to get involved as a voter is, you know, to vote in the general election for a senator or the president of the United States, think again. You know, vote for district attorneys. Vote in sheriff's races. Vote in judicial races. Look for candidates. Demand candidates that care.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, we have a caller on the line. LaWanna, you're live. You want to make a comment or you have a question?
Yes, thank you so much. The bottom line is when a judge rules somebody to three life sentences or 2 days to life, or that stuff is just as sick as it can get. These are not human beings. These are cruel, mental-minded, crazy people that... This is pure hate. How do I do that to anybody for any reason? I don't need you to tell me that you're going to be there for three life. I mean, it shouldn't be allowed to be said. This justice system is so broke until there are no words to describe it. There are no words. And these human beings, these aren't even human beings, these so-called human animals that can do this kind of stuff and sentence people to such things and have no kind of feeling or any kind of emotion, they've lost all kind of conscious feelings and emotions as such as human beings are supposed to have. This is just ridiculous. You know why? Because they feel like, well, I can do whatever I want to do. I'm not held in question about it. Nobody, I don't have to answer anybody. Well, however I'm feeling today, if I don't feel like giving you a couple of years, if I don't like you because of the way you look or how tall you are, or how fat you are, or how dark or light or whatever you are, then I'm just not in a good mood today. I'm going to give you 20 years. You don't give a human being. Human beings change every second. You don't just say, well, I'm going to give you all this power. So what makes them so different from anybody else? What makes them so different except they have no conscience and they feel like they're all that because they're on a, sitting up there and can do whatever they want to do and they're not held in question about it. Everybody has to answer. Everybody should be accountable for their actions. Everybody should have to answer. There should be a set things across the board for this crime, it don't matter your color, your age, or nothing, unless you're a little kid. It ought to be across the board that this is what this gets. It's not what deciding on why I decided to give this one 4 years, and I gave this one 10 years, and I gave this one life, and I gave this one this. No, it should be a set thing for each crime. This is what each crime should have. It shouldn't be where whatever mood I'm in today, I can just decide to give you what I want to give you. Now, there should be rules for everything. And good rules, right rules, not crooked, underhanded, snaky rules, real rules that are real and just and fair and honest to every American citizen in the United States, no matter who they are. And everything is punishable according to the crime. And the crime, I don't care if whatever you did, nobody to me, ever. Why should you gonna be in there for life? It don't take that to reform anybody. It does not take that. And I'm going to give you this. If you come out and do something else again, okay, we'll have to up your sentence. But give people a chance, for God's sake. They don't even try to say, some people, it don't take everything for them to say, I'm making a change. But they're just going to beat you to death. And then when you get into blame prison, they kill you while you're in there and abuse you and treat you like trash and feed you and treat you like an animal. This system stinks. It stinks, and I'll be glad when God's justice comes down and does something about it. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. And I think one of the things that that you have to look at with that caller, Mike, is that the immunity that the judges and the prosecutors have. And, you know, on one hand, sure, they need to not be sued by, you know, every so-called criminal that has really committed a crime and wants to come back on them. But to give them blanket immunity where you can say a prosecutor can basically break the law while he's prosecuting me to get his conviction. And you can say that a judge can basically, you know, it's bad enough they have a lifetime appointment, these federal judges, but then you can say they can do whatever they want. They can do immoral acts. They can do what they want, and there is no accountability. That is the piece that you say, okay, when you do get these crooked judges and these judges, like you say, that you would think that their conscience would say, you know what, I'm getting up, I'm not giving this person for selling $500 worth of marijuana, I'm not giving this person 50 years in prison, I'm walking away from this. When you have the judges that feel like, you know, hey, there's no repercussions of whatever I do. If I want to do whatever I do in a courtroom and there's no accountability, nobody can hold me in question. You get the out of control ones, the crazy ones, the ones that just have this God complex, and they do what they want to do. And the immunity that's given to them, I mean, I understand they voted it for themselves, the prosecutor and the judges, but that is another thing that we need to tackle, to say, no, if you break the law, you are held to the bounds of the law, just as I am, as any other citizen, as a judge, prosecutor, or just a layman. You break the law, you are judged by the law. And they say no one's above the law, but when you look at this blanket immunity for prosecutors and judges, yes, they are.
I agree absolutely. I mean, it's one of the most infuriating things is the, just the inability for citizens, whether they've been wronged or not, to hold prosecutors accountable for shady tactics and shady behavior. And, you know, it's you see the sort of the same thing on the same level with law enforcement, which is that this whole group in the criminal justice system, they've come to work so closely together since, you know, basically since the invention of plea bargaining, that cops and prosecutors and way too many judges see themselves as all three on the same side.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not supposed to be. We're supposed to have checks and balances. The legislature is supposed to hold the judges accountable by creating laws. And prosecutors are supposed to hold police accountable by saying, like, if you break the law, I will prosecute you too. And
right.
Somewhere in there, somebody is supposed to be able to hold prosecutors accountable, but I'm not sure who that is, right? I mean, maybe they're supposed to hold themselves accountable. But part of the problem, I think, is that you've got this system where all these people have gotten so chummy that, A, they don't want to criticize or attack or out someone who they have to work with every day, and B, they come to realize, well, hey, nobody's going to out me either. You know, so it's a very, very vicious cycle, and one of the reasons that we focus so much of our work on Congress, or when we're working in states, we're working in Florida, Massachusetts right now, one of the reasons we focus so much on the legislature is that it's very hard to hold people accountable in the criminal justice system if you don't have your legislature on board.
Right.
You know, if we didn't have, you know, Congressman Bobby Scott just taken to the mic every single day and being like, this doesn't work, we need to change. And he's working with his members in Congress who are both Republican and Democrat saying, like, look, regardless of what our differences are, you got to hear me out. I mean, it's people like him. They're like, they're all we got. You know, it's them and then anybody in a state or local office that you can vote in or out, which in some states, like I said earlier, is district attorneys, judges, sheriffs. But we don't have, as citizens, we don't have a lot of options for checking prosecutors and judges and law enforcement. It's pretty terrifying sometimes.
So, Mike, quick question for you. I know that Pam, you know, focuses a lot on the mandatory minimums when it comes to drug charges. But, you know, I look at this as an opportunity for the door to be open to other legislation, which spreads across the board to some of the other nonviolent charges, or those who've been convicted and sentenced based on nonviolent charges, you know, which is also a burden on the BOP's budget when you're talking, like, you know, in the case of the IRP6, where we talk about here on the program quite a bit, where you have six gentlemen who have never been convicted of anything, never committed any crimes, yet they are incarcerated for seven, or convicted and sentenced to 7 to 11 years in prison, when, you know, they would be better served, would better serve the community, which is what they were doing anyway, outside of prison. But do you think that this activity and this traction that we're getting through initiatives like what FAM is involved in can spread across the board to other initiatives?
Yeah, and I hope it would, because drug offenders are obviously not the only people who are receiving excessively long sentences. It's just, it's more like a life cycle thing. Like, you know, it's 30 years later, the dad is in, we have a good idea of just the insane amount of damage these sentences have done. And so now people are saying, okay, this 30 years is more than enough time to know this experiment didn't work. Let's fix things. And there are other nonviolent offenders doing long sentences at the federal level and a ton at the state levels, where, you know, in states that have three strikes or that have, like you said, indeterminate sentencing that we were talking about earlier. And it's not just drug offenders. I mean, one of the groups one of the types of offenders that FAM works with a lot, and it sometimes makes people uncomfortable, is gun offenders. You know, you can get a decades-long sentence for owning a firearm just because you shouldn't. You know, if you have a felony conviction for having sold marijuana at one point and you later buy a firearm because you're a collector or home protection, you know, that can be 10, 15, 20, 25 years. So we're trying to work with a lot of different people, and drugs are kind of like the low-hanging fruit right now, just because we know our drug laws don't work, and B, we know that you know, that African Americans have been disproportionately affected more than any other racial or ethnic group. So it's like, we know it's unfair. And I hope it doesn't take 30 years for all the other crimes that we need to fix the sentences for. But drugs were kind of the low-hanging fruit.
So, Mike, how can folks get in contact with you and get involved in the initiatives that Families Against Mandatory Minimums is pushing for?
Yeah, so my email address is, my name again is Mike Riggs, and my email address is mriggs, M-R-I-G-G-S, at famm.org. And your listeners can also find me on Twitter. My handle is at Mike Riggs, M-I-K-E-R-I-G-G-S.
Mike Riggs, Communications Director for FAM, that's Families Against Mandatory Minimums, and we appreciate you spending a little time with us this evening, Mike, and we will post this interview out on our website at ajcradio.com. Again, ajcradio.com. We will also post information as to how our listeners can contact Mike Riggs. Thank you again, sir. Stay warm out there in the D.C. area. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Don't go anywhere. We will be right back. At the inception of A Just Cause Coast to Coast, the host and crew decided to devote a segment of each show to an exoneree moment. The purpose of the exoneree moment was to outline the case and highlight the circumstances that led to a wrongful conviction. AJC Radio also wanted to highlight the successes and failures of the justice system, understanding why the system failed and what ultimately turned the tide and cleared their name. We wanted to hear the personal first-hand accounts. They were appalling, emotional, astounding, and overwhelming. Lives devastated by the system. Most of the people who shared their stories were released from the building, but not from the system. They struggled to get their records expunged and clear their names, find suitable employment and housing, obtain restitution from the state, and reconnect with their families and friends. And it hardly fit the definition of exonerated, which means to free from guilt of blame, to clear from a charge of guilt or fault, to exculpate. These are the stories of lives taken and returned, but must be rebuilt, adapted, reestablished, and transformed. The profile of a wrongly convicted.
Today's file features Vincent Thames. On the morning of November 7, 1994, the body of Nina Glover was discovered in a dumpster in the Englewood neighborhood of Chicago's South Side. Glover had been brutally raped and murdered, and an autopsy concluded that she had been killed by strangulation. No arrests were made in the case for 4 months. On March 7, 1995, 18-year-old Jerry Fincher walked into the police station and voluntarily came forward with information about Glover's murder. He was hoping to gain some consideration for a friend of his who was in custody. Over the next 2 days, while in police custody, Fincher gave an evolving series of statements indicating that he had participated with others in the abduction, rape, and murder of Glover in the basement of the house of Vincent Thames, age 18. He also implicated Terrell Swift, 17, Harold Richardson, 16, and Michael Saunders, 15. Thames, Swift, Richardson, and Saunders were all arrested, and each of them eventually signed a confession that they participated in the rape and murder of Glover. Not a trace of physical evidence that connected any of the five teenagers to the rape and murder was found in any relevant site. Not in Thames' basement, not near the dumpster, and not in any of the boys' clothing. At the request of some of the defendants, pre-trial DNA testing was done, and that testing excluded all five of the charged teenagers as the source of semen. At a pre-trial hearing, Jerry Fincher's statement was determined to have been coerced and was suppressed as evidence. Charges against him were dismissed after he spent 3.5 years in custody. In May 1998, Swift, Richardson, and Saunders all proceeded to separate trials before Judge Thomas Sumner, sitting without a jury. The only significant evidence presented against each defendant was his own confession. Judge Sumner convicted all three defendants who went to trial. He's sentenced Swift to 30 years, Saunders to 40 years, and Richardson to 40 years. After seeing the sentences of the other defendants, Thames pleaded guilty in exchange for a sentence of 30 years. On December 3, 2010, Swift and Saunders filed a motion for an order to conduct a more advanced form of DNA testing than was done before the trial, and to upload the results into the state DNA database to try and identify the real murderer. On May 13, 2011, the Illinois State Police reported a hit to the offender in the state DNA database. The offender was Johnny Douglas, by then deceased, who was one of the first people that police interviewed about the Glover murder in 1994. Douglas had been arrested 83 times and convicted of crimes 38 times between July 1980 and April 1998, many of them sexual assault and attacks on women. On November 16, 2011, based on DNA evidence, Judge Paul Beeble Jr. vacated the convictions of Swift, Saunders, Richardson, and Thames. In September 2012, Swift, Thames, Richardson, and Saunders were granted certificates of innocence. All four men filed federal lawsuits against the city, the Chicago Police Department, and Cook County prosecutors, alleging they were framed for the crime. This has been a profile of the wrongly convicted with AJC Radio.
You are listening to AJC Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. You know, FAM is doing a lot of stuff there to get some laws passed, and you know, it's taken a while, as Mr. Riggs has indicated, but you know, with all of the things that are occurring right now within the judicial system in the United States, you have crime rates going down, prison populations going up, sentencing over the top. You got, you know, we're setting the record as far as the number of exonerations. So obviously, you know, things have not worked in the past. So this is getting the attention of a lot of our people in Congress these days, especially as Mr. Riggs talked about the human cost. You know, also in that press conference that Senator Mike Lee was a part of, there was Senator Dick Durbin, and Senator Durbin talked about a family that was put into an awkward situation. And when you hear these members of Congress talk about people who were convicted on drug charges, but then they take it a step further and look at some of the extenuating circumstances that put them there, and then look at the results of the excessive sentencing. Mm-hmm. Those are the kind of things where they can see that, you know, eventually, and as Mr. Riggs said, you know, our prison system is bursting at the seams. And so let's listen to that clip from Senator Durbin, and then we'll come back and talk about it.
And I think Senator Lee has put his finger on it. We want to keep America safe. We want to make sure that dangerous people are arrested, convicted, and put behind bars. But we don't want to overdo it if we don't have to. And the reason is, it not only has a direct impact on these criminal defendants, their lives, and their futures, it costs a fortune. Billions of dollars that could be spent to prevent the commission of crimes and to make certain that we have the most effective prosecution, sadly, is put into long and lengthy prison sentences, which really don't square up with the offense. So we really deal with one particular category of offense here. We're talking about drug offenses that don't involve guns, don't involve gangs, don't involve violence, but offenses that are wrong and should be treated as wrong, but should be squared away with mandatory minimum sentences which reflect the reality of the situation. I was listening as Senator Lee talked about meeting one of his constituents. I had a similar experience a few years ago with a hearing where I met the brother of Eugenia Jennings, a young woman, teenager, who was a crack addict with three small children, on her third offense selling crack to buy food for her children, was arrested, convicted, and sentenced to over 20 years in prison. Over 20 years for selling what, in fact, was a handful of crack. That sort of thing is totally disproportionate to the wrong that she had done. She was fortunate. Her sentence was considered by the president. She was released. She's since passed away from cancer, but she spent the last year of her life with her three children on the outside. When I met with her in the federal prison in Greenville, Illinois, Eugenia Jennings looked me in the eye after serving 12 years for those three little containers of crack cocaine and said, "Senator, if I get out of here, I promise you I will never do anything wrong the rest of my life." She kept that promise. It was a short life, but she kept that promise. Our exploding prison population eats up a quarter of the Justice Department's discretionary budget. These runaway expenditures are undermining our other law enforcement efforts. U.S. Attorney's Office and the DEA have already lost hundreds of positions, and resources for state and local law enforcement have decreased dramatically. It's time that we act quickly on this bipartisan legislation. I think it is a critical part of restoring our system of justice to where it should be, keeping America safe, serving the needs of justice, but making certain that the excesses come to an end.
So, you know, when you listen to Senator Durbin talk about some of the initiatives that are underway with regard to sentencing reform, you know, and he mentions the case of Eugenia Jennings. And you know, I have to go back again to one of the things that Mr. Riggs from FAM was talking about. And he was saying that, you know, excessive sentencing it's not going to fix the social issues like Ms. Jennings and having to sell crack in order to feed her children. That's a totally different area where we as a nation shouldn't have people out on the street selling crack because they can't feed their families.
That's right.
You know, and then the other thing that Mr. Riggs talked about was, you know, it's not going to fix institutional racism, nor is it going to fix, you know, prosecutorial misconduct. So, you know, when you have folks like, you know, Senator Lee, Senator Durbin, and gosh, I mean, it's a whole shopping list of the bipartisan players in this thing. I mean, you have Senator Patrick Leahy, Cory Booker, Chris Coon, Senator Dick Durbin, and then Jeff Flake, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Mike Lee. You also have Raul Labrador, Bobby Scott, and Thomas Massie, and John Conyers, just to name a few of them. But you got a lot of people that are jumping on board on this. And as Senator Durbin just said in that clip, when you have 25% of your budget going to support the prisons, that in and of itself should point to the fact that is a massive, serious problem.
And it shows that, you know, it's not working. With 30 years of data on just this one issue of the over-criminalization of petty drug charges, you would think that every member of Congress would be on board with this. They say, look, we got 30 years of data. It's not working. We need to change these laws. We need to transform them at the fabric of what they are. They are not working. And I guess you understand because it's all about votes in the end, but you would think that any member of Congress would realize that this is common sense. It will make their constituents look at them and say, hey, you know, they actually made a bipartisan decision. They were part of something that happened good. They came to a sensible conclusion about a law, because we don't find that much as far as our laws. There's always the bickering back and forth, and they end up coming with usually some crazy decision that they're trying to say, okay, you know, they're trying to see if this will get them more votes. But something as simple as this that says, hey, we're going to save 25% of a federal budget. I mean, that's taxpayer money. We're going to get people out of prison that they don't belong there. And we're going to keep people that should never go in, you know, spend the money on something like rehab, on programs, on education. Something sensible that says, hey, if a person is selling drugs to feed their family, instead of putting them in prison, how about help them
and teach them a way to go make a viable living. That just seems so common sense that, okay, we'll go that route instead of putting you in prison. We'll, if you're addicted to drugs, we'll put you in rehab. We'll give you some type of help program. If you're not, and you're just selling drugs, we're going to give you some type of education to teach you that there is a viable way to make money called getting a job that makes you a viable part of society that is useful instead of locking you up in prison. We got a caller. Karen, you are live. You have a question or comment? Hello, Karen?
Did we lose Karen? Well, you know, Cliff, while Karen chimes back in or tries to reconnect, we'll go back to that call. But, you know, one of the things, if I may kind of divert a little bit to the IRP6 case.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, David Banks did a blog about a year ago where he was addressing the issue of the cost of incarceration. And in this situation, we talked about the IRP6, how you have six gentlemen who have never been incarcerated, never committed any crimes. They were starting a business. They were going, you know, the business in and of itself,
right,
was going to generate revenue for the state in which they live, as well as provide a benefit to the federal government, local law enforcement, as well as state law enforcement across the nation. The whole initiative behind the IRP6 and IRP Solutions was to develop the software that would help, you know, in situations like right now. We have ISIS that's running rampant, and, you know, you got folks in Europe that are scared now because you got ISIS camps that are 150 miles away from their borders and just jump on a boat and they're, you know, on their homeland. So, you know, the type of software that IRP Solutions was developing was going to help fight those kind of things. Yet in this situation, you have six men who were active in their community, as you were saying earlier, Cliff.
Mm-hmm.
They were active in their church, doing a lot of outreach stuff, and viable contributors to their community. Yet now they're in prison. They are a liability from a financial standpoint,
right,
to the federal government. And David Banks, in his blog, and you can go out to freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org, and click on the stand-up blog, and you'll see where David ran the numbers. And just in the prison where they are now, where they've been wrongfully convicted, wrongfully incarcerated for over 2.5 years, it costs $16 million, you know, for the entire population that's there. Now, you're talking doctors, lawyers, you know, and all the categories like what Dick Durbin was talking about as far as nonviolent, does not involve weapons or anything like that.
Right.
Why pay to incarcerate people like this who are upstanding citizens who got wrongfully convicted and put a burden on the budget like that?
Absolutely. It makes absolutely no sense.
So yeah. Has Karen
Let's go to the phones. Karen, you're live. Are you with us now?
Yeah, I'm with you now. I don't know what happened. I was just listening all along on the call. But, you know, talking about selling crack and the poverty and the race and the discretion that they use, you know, in sentencing and things like that, you know, I know that changing the laws is the biggest task because a lot of them are not going to get out filling out, you know, writing their motions or whatever they do. They won't get relief like that because the prosecutors still have control of a lot of that. And,
right,
you know, but the main thing after, if the biggest thing is changing the laws, as I said, but unless they reconsider addiction, you know, this is going to go on. It's not going to stop. Because the first thing they do is lock them up. They should do like a lot of other countries that we hear. They treat drug use and addiction as an illness, and they give them treatment because clearly when they're out in the street committing these crimes, continuously doing something that they know is against the law, they don't stop because they're simply not thinking clearly. You know, when they get in, they begin to probably get some kind of slowdown as far as not getting as many drugs in prison. You know, but my concern is after these things go on, when they're returning, after they can get anywhere from 10 years to life on these mandatory minimum sentences, and they've done 20, 25 or something like that, or some of them never even thought they were coming home, and all of a sudden they've got some relief with a sentence change, you know, a law change, and they get out, they're not ready for returning. You know,
absolutely.
So talk about, you know, so when you talk about changing the laws and then addiction, and if there's some kind of treatment at first, that they don't need to be incarcerated in the beginning.
That's right, because addiction is not a crime. And thanks for your comment, Karen. But yeah, addiction is not the crime. Addiction is a sickness that they need help. Go ahead, Lamont. You wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, and to Karen's point, here's the issue you have. You know, Congress can spend all day long doing reform.
Mm.
The issue is there has to be an addressing of the issue. And they're not looking at. I don't believe people in society or Congress is looking at the big picture.
Right.
Now, you can go through the reform and do all of that, but we need to have it also where these men and women, when they get out, you're talking about, well, you can get a job and you can do this, and this was Congress said, let's put these people to work. Number one, you have to address the fact that a felony is on their record. Employers will not hire them. So what I have found in the 7 years that I said wrongfully incarcerated, there was a guy that got out. He was back in 3 weeks. You know why? Man. They paroled him to a homeless shelter and said, because you are hanging around felons, we are regressing you back to prison for violation of your parole. So explain this to me. How do you parole me to a homeless shelter downtown Denver?
How am I supposed to know who I'm hanging around?
Well, they're homeless people. A lot of them have nothing but drugs. And I'm not saying all homeless people do drugs. I'm simply saying that's what you're going to be around. But then you say, well, those are felons. So because you interacted or came in contact, we are regressing you. When I was in prison wrongfully, we were told that 65% of the population in prison in the state of Colorado were back in prison for technical violations, not of a new crime, 65%. Just think about that number.
On a technical violation.
You know what? You were 10 minutes late. I told you the story about the guys that were at the halfway house. It was a snowstorm that hit Colorado. There, the bus breaks down on the way to get them back to the halfway house. They call the person there and say, look, I mean, it's a snowstorm. People are saying on the news, stay in. Don't go anywhere. Okay? These guys are running up North Nevada Avenue in the snow, trying their best to avoid going back to prison. Guess what? He calls them and says, we are up the street. We are coming. By the time he arrived there, the sheriff was waiting to put them back in county jail and regress them because, you know what? They missed curfew by about 10 minutes.
Wow. Now that is nowhere near being justice. Let's go back to the phones. We got Wayne. You have a question or a comment. You're live.
I've got a comment. I've been listening to the show, and, you know, it's so bad how people are treated. But I think one of the things that I wanted to say is I don't think this is an accident. I think this is by design. There is so much money to be made in halfway houses and prisons. I believe the system is the way that it is because there are corporations and people making millions, maybe billions of dollars off of the prison system, and it is set up to, you know, to be a revolving door. It's not about reform. It's about once I get you in the system, I want to make money off of you for the rest of your life, whether it's making money off of you as slave labor, making money off of you paying the parole system, taking everything from you to make money, and that's my comment.
Thanks for your comment, Wayne.
Go ahead, Sam.
No, go ahead, Lamont. I'll hold on.
No, there was just one quick point I wanted to make. We were talking about the issue where the problem lies.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back, Cliff, to what you said to the prosecutors, the immunity issue, which is insanely bad. Again, there is no accountability. So in my particular case, do you know the appellate court cited the prosecution to have broken the law 25 times during my trial?
Wow.
25 times, and what they were cited for prosecution of misconduct. And here's the kicker. The Supreme Court for the state of Colorado came down 3 months before my trial ever started and said, this is categorically wrong, unacceptable, do not do it. They did it over 25 times in a two-day period during my trial.
And you spent 7 years in prison, and then they came back and said, well, we found prosecutorial misconduct.
And no consequences to these prosecutors. Matter of fact, the prosecutor that prosecuted me in my first trial was promoted in the DA's office here in Colorado Springs.
We need to get him live.
And that's show. Donna Bellick, the lady who did what she did.
We need to get her on the show.
Hey Cliff, I just wanted to go back to the caller, Karen. And she kind of sparked my curiosity when she, obviously when we're talking about the initiatives under FAM and a lot of the reforms that are pointed toward those who've been unjustly sentenced as a result of drug charges. And she brought up the issue of, or the question of drug addiction and drug treatment. So, you know, that kind of sparked my curiosity a little bit. And out on the website for the National Institute of Drug Abuse, National Institute of Drug Abuse, they did a study on the cost. And so, you know, as I stated, you know, David Banks did the numbers and accurately, you know, shows that it could cost anywhere from, you know, $24,000 to $30,000 per person to incarcerate them. According to the National Institute of Drug Abuse, a one-year drug treatment program, let's say for methadone, a methadone maintenance treatment, $4,700 per patient per year.
Wow.
So, you know, Karen makes a valid point that, and it seems to bear out here based on the research from the National Institute of Drug Abuse, that if there were treatment programs put in place, then that's going to help the recidivism rate. And so you're not going to just release people out onto the street only to have them come back, like you said, Lamont, 3 days later, you know, whether it's a technical issue or whether it's an actual violation. You know, we do have to look at all of have to look at the whole picture, as you were saying, Lamont, from the standpoint that and we've heard it time and time again that people are released in a lot of cases with the expectation that we will see you again. You're going to come back. We're going to keep your palate in the corner for you because you're going to come back. When if we devote the time and the effort to preventing them from coming back, then we won't have the prison overcrowding. We won't have the burdens that are placed on the budget. Lamont, you had something?
Yeah, and let these people get a job. Clear their records. Seal their records.
Oh, they're not going to do that.
You know, but these are the answers to making an ex-drug offender believe that he can get out and get a job, that he can. You got to give them hope again.
When they get out and the only job they can get is a minimum wage job and you can barely pay rent, you can't buy food for your kids, you can't do the things you need to do, then they act like they're surprised that they turn around and go back to what they were doing to make money. They have to find a way to make money. If you're not going to give them a chance, they have to do what they have. They have to find a way to make money.
And they're going
to
do what they know to do.
Yeah, they're going to resort back to what they know.
I mean, a friend of mine right now who got out of prison a few months ago is in the homeless shelter right now. Because you know what? He's been to 7 to 8 different apartment complexes in Denver. Nobody will give him a place for his wife and his kid. You know why? Well, you have a felony. And we wonder why. So though I applaud Congress for what they are doing, and I do, we have to go further. How do we help these men then become and women become productive once they leave? You know, that's legislation that can happen. We're ordering you that these records be sealed. And I think the other caller that called in earlier made the point. You know what? Give people an opportunity.
That's right.
I have found out with my stay in prison for what I went through, you know what? It doesn't take 10 years to get it. It takes a few nights of being away from your family and away from the people that you love to recognize this is not a place I want to be. So you don't have to give me 50 years. I'm going to get it probably within a year.
Well, and here's another stat for you, you know, kind of going back to that caller you were talking about, Lamont, when Karen was talking about the drug addiction. And this National Institute of Drug Abuse also points to the fact that there is a treatment gap. And they say that in 2011, there were 21.6 million people aged 12 and older. Now, that in and of itself is crazy, but aged 12 and older, 21.6 million people who needed treatment for drug problems, but only 2.3 received treatment. So do the math. I mean, one pool of folks feeds the other. So you got this drug problem here, and it's going to feed the prison population because there are no programs in place to help prevent it. Yet, drug treatment programs are a whole lot less expensive than incarcerating people. This is Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in a moment.
How often does our justice system get it wrong, convicting innocent people of crimes they did not commit? A new project by the University of Michigan Law School and the Center for Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University School of Law tries to answer that question. In the last 23 years, more than 2,000 people have been convicted of serious crimes and later exonerated, according to the National Registry of Exonerations. By far, the largest segment was almost 1,200 defendants falsely convicted because of large-scale patterns of police corruption, generally in drug and gun cases. Of the remaining 873 defendants exonerated, nearly half were wrongly convicted of murder, and of that group, 101 were sentenced to death. On average, it took more than 11 years for a conviction to be set aside. Why does the justice system get it wrong? In homicides, the biggest problem is perjury and false accusation, most often by supposed eyewitnesses. False convictions in adult rape cases are primarily based on mistakes by eyewitnesses, while false convictions in child sex abuse cases are often for fabricated crimes that never occurred. 2,000 exonerations may seem small in a nation with more than 2.3 million people behind bars, but there are far more false convictions than the report contains. Most false convictions are never formally challenged, and those convictions that are successfully overturned receive little or no attention from the media, according to the report's authors.
When does it stop being partly cloudy and start being partly sunny? Why is the word abbreviation so long? Are English muffins just muffins in England? Why is it called a washing line and not a drying line? Do fish get thirsty? If ghosts can walk through doors, why don't they fall through floors? Do you yawn when you sleep? If prunes are dried plums, how do they make prune juice? Why do doctors leave the room when you change? They're going to see you naked anyway. Do bald chefs wear hairnets? How much deeper would the ocean be if all the sponges were taken out? Do you believe someone who says they're a chronic liar? Why is sandwich bread square and sandwich meat round? Life's full of hard questions. Ask one more. You might just save a life.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. So, you know, this issue of prison reform, sentencing reform, judicial reform, we're hearing that word a lot as far as reform. And you know, there was an article that came out a few days ago by Philip Smith on www.alternet.org. And the title of it is How Congress Can Cut the Federal Prison Population. And so, you know, he points out the fact that there was a letter that was sent to Congress and it was a joint letter by several groups. And the letter basically said that, you know, here are things that you can do. Restore proportionally to drug sentencing. Promote and adequately fund recidivism reduction and reentry programs. Make sentencing reductions retroactive. Expand BOP's compassionate release program, and then expand credits for good behavior. You know, and there are a lot of good things there. I mean, and when you talk about compassionate release programs, you know, there's absolutely no reason why a man or woman should be sitting in prison. Let's say they're dying from cancer or what have you. You would think that they would at least allow them, you know, from a compassionate perspective, allow them to go home and be with their families. And that just brought to my remembrance, Cliff, that, you know, where the IRP6 are incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a doctor that was incarcerated there with him, and his wife came to visit him, and this is at Florence, Colorado, the prison camp in Florence, Colorado. And his wife would come to visit him every weekend. And on one particular weekend, she came to visit, and she was supposed to visit, and she didn't show up. And they found her dead in the hotel room there, you know, near the prison.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Did they let him go home?
No, they wouldn't even let.
He only had, how much time did he have left on his sentence?
He had
3 months left.
Yeah,
yeah.
And these are the type of things that you say, okay, first off, you're in a prison camp.
Yeah.
You are not a threat to society, to the community,
to anyone.
Furthermore, this man is what?
He's about 70 years
old. Yeah, about 70 years old. His wife.
And it was obvious that they were in love. I mean,
right, right.
I mean,
she was there every week. We go there every week. You always saw her there supporting him. And you look at it and you say, okay, what more can you do to this man? He's basically lost the thing that he's lost his life while he was in prison.
Yeah.
And you say, no, we're not gonna let you go to the funeral. We're not gonna let you do anything. We're definitely not letting you go home. And it's like I have days left on my sentence.
And that's considered days.
And
hours.
I mean what benefit do you get from keeping this man locked up at 70 years old?
It goes back to what Mr. Riggs was saying. It's cruel.
Yes.
I mean, it's cruel. He, for all practical purposes, you know, for whatever reason he was incarcerated, he had served his time. And, you know, they should have allowed him to go and be with his family. I mean, under normal conditions, and I would say normal conditions, a person that's not incarcerated, and you lose a loved one,
mm-hmm.
that's an emotional roller coaster that you're going to go through.
Yeah.
Right.
But if you're locked up and you're sitting waiting on that person to come and visit you, and then they don't show up, and then the news gets delivered to you that they're not coming because they passed away, well, can I go and be with my wife? No, you can't.
And nobody really can begin to comprehend the depth of that sorrow behind that wall. You know, you deal with the sorrow of prison. You know, this country used to be a forgiving nation. I don't know what's happened. It sounds like the world has continually gotten colder and colder.
Absolutely.
And until we deal with that issue and hopefully get men and women in positions of power that have a heart for mankind and not about black or white or red or yellow, whatever the color you are, and begin to have and go back to the compassion, the human spirit of compassion for people. This nation is in a major crisis that needs to be fixed. It is the most horrible thing I've ever heard. And that just, I mean, that just wrenches your heart. You know, this guy lost somebody who he cared about, that he loved. And the society tells you, Sam, that the culture, again, is about cruelty and stripping every ounce of hope from you down to you are dead. That is how bad the system has gotten, and that has to be addressed.
And it goes back to the complacency that until it hits home, so to speak, people tend to be oblivious to the atrocities that can exist within our judicial system. But people should not wait until it hits home They should do their research, just like Mr. Riggs from FAM said. They need to do their research and get involved, because it can so easily and so quickly end up on your doorstep. Lisa.
We want to ask everyone to go out to GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com, and do a search on IRP6. If you'd like to contribute something to the IRP6 families that are without their head of household, without their breadwinners and their families, they have needs that are not able to be taken care of because they're missing their loved one. And if you'd like to be able to help, that's where you can find it. Just do a search on IRP6 again, and you will find a link where you can click and donate to those families.
Yeah, I want to read this little piece that Michael Collins, the policy manager at Drug Policy Alliance's Office of National Affairs, said. He said it's clear that there is a path for criminal justice reform in the House and Senate, but lawmakers should ensure that any final bill gets at the root causes of mass incarceration. It's important that legislation doesn't just paper over the cracks, and I couldn't agree with him more.
Absolutely.
And with that, I want to say thank you to our guest, Mike Riggs from FAM, that joined us tonight, took part of his evening out. We appreciate it. Also, to the callers that called in, we appreciate your comments. Everyone in the chat room, we appreciate your comments and questions there as well. Want to say thank you to our production team, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson of K&D Productions, helping out Ill Skills Girl in the control room to make sure you hear what it is that we have to say. To our production support team, they give us accurate and up-to-date information so that we can pass that on to you. And to the truth, we know you out there. We appreciate it.
We'd also like to invite our listeners to tune in each week right here on a Just Cause Coast to Coast from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time for a Just Cause Coast to Coast. Also, you can catch us on archives of our weekly broadcast at ajcradio.com. You can catch 24/7 programming at live365.com. And then each Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and that's at prn.fm. You can get on-demand programming at the405radio.com. Again, the405radio.com. And then also on iTunes. We ask that you like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Always keep the IRP6 in your prayers. That's David Banks, Dave Zapolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. You can find out more information about them at freetheirp6.org. For more information about Just Cause, go to www.a-justcause.com. Click on the donate button. We are a 501c3. We also suggest that you contact your financial advisor regarding any benefits that you might receive as a result of donating to a nonprofit. Also on our website, you'll find helpful resources to help you do some of that research that you want to look more into how to help with judicial reform. So anybody got anything else?
Just want to say thank you to Ms. Barbara and Olivia for doing all the hard work that we can't do while we're on the air. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. On behalf of Lisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart, and Lamont Banks, I'm Sam Thurman. Good night, America.
Good night.
Good night.